5 countries, the USA, the Soviet Union, Britain, France, and China, formed the permanent members of the Security Council, the crucial body with powers of veto over any decision. But of these, Britain and France were greatly weakened by the war and faced mounting problems in their colonial empires, while China was crippled after 8 years of war with Japan and racked by the continuing civil war between nationalists and communists. Plainly, the only dominant powers were the USA and USSR. They demarcated the new Europe in their own image, and each interpreted its post-war role as part of a wider ideological mission. Liberalization and democratization as the outward extension of American political and economic philosophy encountered monopoly communist control of the state and direction of the economy. Clash of such polar opposites couldn't be long delayed. It would turn into a global, not just European, contest for power. But there was an imbalance. For the USA, Europe, though vitally important, was far from American shores. Communism was geographically distant, though perceived as a growing threat. For Stalin, Europe was on his doorstep, and had imperiled his country's existence twice within a generation. The forces of international capitalism were, moreover, undefeated, still a mighty enemy. Stalin's overriding concern wasn't the export of revolution, but the safeguarding of Soviet security. Europe, therefore, would inevitably be the main battleground of the Cold War, and within Europe, Germany, where the ideological antagonists stood cheek by jowl, would just as inevitably become the epicenter of the conflict. The prospect of Soviet expansion in Europe was already before the end of the war concerning the British Foreign Office. The Americans were at that time more well-disposed towards Stalin. But the spectre of Soviet power extending its grip in Europe and beyond started before long to preoccupy the American State Department as well. Containment was soon the key concept, especially after George F. Kennan, a diplomat in the American embassy in Moscow, had warned in dark tones in a famous long telegram of February 1946 of the need to prevent Soviet expansion, which he envisaged as being pursued through infiltration and political pressure rather than direct military intervention. However exaggerated in retrospect such anxieties proved to be, in 1946, they were palpable. The Soviet Union had that spring, belatedly and reluctantly, withdrawn from Iran, occupied by both Soviet and British forces since 1941. The Americans also saw serious grounds for concern in 1946 when the Soviets exerted pressure on Turkey to yield control over the Turkish Straits, the Dardanelles and Bosphorus, though Stalin eventually backed down in the autumn. More worrying still was the situation in Greece. Stalin had been content in 1944-45, as agreed with Churchill, to leave Greece in the British sphere of influence, and had given the communists no help in their insurgency. But when the insurrection began again in March 1946, supported by Tito's Yugoslavia, though still with little help from Stalin, communist advances led to the first deployment of the containment policy. The danger of the Greek Civil War providing the opening for Soviet expansion seemed real to the Americans, all the more so when the British Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin told them in February that a financially enfeebled Britain could no longer provide military or economic aid to Greece and Turkey. From March 1947 onwards, the United States provided the Greek right with military aid and training that proved decisive in defeating the left. Though the huge losses, around 45,000 killed and immense material damage, and subsequent repression, inflicted lasting harm on Greece's prospects for genuine national unity. For the USA, however, containment had proved a success. The president, Harry S. Truman, had even declared it a doctrine, support for free peoples against totalitarianism to hold back the spread of communism. It became the mantra of the Cold War. Germany especially was meanwhile coming to be seen as a decisive testing ground. Friction between the occupying powers had grown during 1946 as the Soviets proved economically uncooperative, as the pressure built to give communist parties outright dominance in the Soviet zone, and as the eastern zone of occupation went increasingly its own way. It had initially been envisaged that American troops would pull out of Europe in 1947, but in a major speech in September 1946, the American Secretary of State, James F. Byrne, announced that American troops would be staying. Byrne acknowledged the failure of unified administration of Germany through the Allied Control Council, as envisaged at Potsdam, and indicated that economic recovery for Germany, seen as vital to the whole of Western Europe, would have to be undertaken on a zonal basis. He opened up the prospect of forming an economic unit between the American zone and the other Western zones. By January 1947, this had become reality in the formation of the bi-zone between the United States and Britain. With that, the formal division of Germany into separate states became only a matter of time. The decisive moment in the division of Europe came in June 1947 with the announcement by the US Secretary of State, George C. Marshall, of a wide-ranging European recovery plan. The Marshall Plan, as it's usually called, was a step of great symbolic significance, profoundly political in aim, if economic in method, and of huge psychological importance in giving West Europeans new hope. It didn't, as is often believed, create Europe's post-war prosperity. Whatever the mythology that became attached to it, the plan was simply too limited in scale to do that. It was highly important, nevertheless. Economic growth predated the Marshall Plan and reached back to 1945. All West European countries, apart from Germany, already registered higher capital formation in 1948, the year that Marshall aid started to flow, than in 1938. And only in Germany, massively, and Italy marginally, did the gross national product remain lower than a decade earlier. But the Marshall Plan undoubtedly boosted the recovery. The index of gross national product in Western Europe increased from 87 to 102 between 1948 and 1950, taking 1938 to be 100, the beginning of a prolonged steep rise. The volume of exports also grew substantially, and the revival of London capital markets helped trade within Europe and beyond, not least investment in rebuilding transport networks and the modernization of infrastructure benefited from Marshall aid. Defenders of the aid program on both sides of the Atlantic claimed at the time that the Marshall Plan was about saving Europe from economic collapse. This was also an exaggeration. Though Europe was certainly still contending with drastic economic problems in 1947, agricultural output was a third lower than before the war. Industrial production had by then still not recovered to its pre-war level. Housing and food shortages were acute. Not only were these particularly disastrous in Germany, where industrial production was still languishing, as was becoming ever plainer to the Western Allies, without German economic recovery, the rest of the continent would be held back. Prospects of recovery were greatly hindered by inflation, as the supplies of money outstripped available goods to match the pent-up demand. In Hungary, Romania, and Greece, the currency collapsed. French prices were four times as high as they had been before the war. In Germany, the amount of money in circulation was seven times higher. In Italy, 20 times higher than in 1938. Cigarettes and other commodities often replaced worthless currency in a barter economy. Inflation was only gradually brought under control through austerity measures and currency reform through devaluation. But the main problem hindering European economic recovery by 1947 was the dollar gap, the shortage of dollars to pay for desperately needed imports of raw materials and capital goods for investment. This imbalance wrecked the arrangements carefully devised at the Bretton Woods Conference only 3 years earlier for the liberalisation of trade based on currencies pegged to the dollar. Precisely this obstacle to sustained economic recovery was what the Marshall Plan set out to overcome. European countries were given over $12 billion, 2% of US gross national product, over a period of 4 years. Britain was the greatest beneficiary, receiving more than twice the amount provided for West Germany. Almost all of it went to repay British debts. But the impact of the plan was greatest in West Germany, Italy, and Austria, the former enemy countries. This was symbolic as well as economic. These countries were now made to feel that they were no longer enemies, but part of an American-sponsored project that offered the prospects of long-term recovery and political stability. The Marshall Plan was anything but altruistic. It helped American as well as European business, since most of the goods bought under the plan were purchased from the USA. But beyond economic considerations, the plan was overtly political. From its conception, it was viewed as a weapon in the incipient Cold War, helping to make Europe economically strong, and within Europe, revitalizing the prostrate economic giant Germany, would tie the western half of the continent to American interests and provide the firmest barrier to Soviet expansionism. All European countries, including the Soviet Union, were offered Marshall aid. As Marshall himself had anticipated and hoped, however, the Soviet Union rejected it, forcing the countries in their sphere of influence, including with great reluctance Poland and Czechoslovakia, to follow suit. Finland, anxious to avoid possible repercussions from the Soviet Union, also declined. Stalin's refusal of Marshall aid was a decisive move. Was it a huge mistake? Rejection denied Eastern Europe any possible benefits that the stimulus of the Marshall Plan could have provided. And in the eyes of millions of Europeans, it handed the moral as well as a political high ground to the Americans. But from Stalin's perspective, worried that the security of the Soviet Union and its satellites was vulnerable to the superior economic power of the United States, refusing Marshall aid determined that there could be no Western interference in the consolidation of Soviet power in Eastern Europe. His fear, most likely justified, was that economic aid from the USA was a vehicle which would have undermined Soviet political dominance in its satellite states. Stalin's decision meant the definitive split of Europe into two halves. The 16 European countries and representatives from the western zones of Germany, outside the Soviet bloc, went ahead, and by April 1948 had formed the Organization for European Economic Cooperation, OEEC, to coordinate the implementation of the plan. It presaged what would turn out to be a lasting division, not just along the line of the Iron Curtain, but among the West European states themselves. The Americans had envisaged the economic and also political integration of Western Europe. The Marshall Plan was predicated upon steps in this direction, initially towards a European customs union, though involving a supranational organization. The Americans thought of constructing a new Western Europe in the image of the USA. But the European countries were driven by their individual national interests. These would swiftly frustrate, then defeat, American notions of European integration. As a US diplomat George Kennan witheringly put it, Europeans had neither the political strength nor clarity of vision to draft a new design for Europe. Scandinavians were pathologically nervous about the Russians, the British were seriously sick, and the other nations suffered from a similar lack of resolve to that which afflicted the British. France's leaders saw the country's national interest above all as providing security against the prospect of a rebuilt Germany and renewed military might that could again draw on the economic power of Ruhr heavy industry. This paramount interest wouldn't be best served by the type of free trade economic integration favored by the United States. France's own post-war plans for reconstruction rested on the internationalization of the Ruhr to guarantee access to German coal and coke, weakening Germany permanently in the process. But when, in June 1948, the Western Allies decided to establish a unitary West German state, France was compelled to alter its policy into one of prospective cooperation on the allocation of German fuel resources and steel output. It was the genius of the crucial Franco-German understanding that would form the basis of the later European Economic Community. Britain had very different national interests. London policymakers saw only disadvantages for Britain in the European Customs Union, an obvious starting point for future integration, envisaged in the Marshall Plan. Senior civil servants believed that there is no attraction for us in long-term economic cooperation with Europe. They feared that such a step would subject Britain eventually to damaging economic competition, prevent the government taking independent steps towards recovery at home, aggravate the dollar drain, and thereby increase dependence upon US aid. Not least, British national interests were seen to lie in ties with the Commonwealth and a revival of world trade. The American diplomat William L. Clayton, one of the key figures behind the Marshall Plan, was close to the mark in his assessment. The trouble with the British is that they're hanging on by their eyelashes to the hope that somehow or other, with our help, they will be able to preserve the British Empire and their leadership of it. As George Marshall himself summed up, Britain wanted to benefit fully from a European program, while at the same time maintaining the position of not being wholly a European country. Some of the smaller European states took a similar stance to that of Britain. The American aim of European economic integration was, therefore, a non-starter. European economic cooperation, when it gradually emerged, wouldn't flow from the Marshall Plan, but from the subsequent Franco-German rapprochement on Ruhr, coal and steel, and Britain would have no part of it. By the autumn of 1948, the economic divide of Europe was matching the political rift. The Soviet Union established the Cominform, Communist Information Bureau, the successor to the Comintern, in October, with a designated aim to block what it called the American plan for the enslavement of Europe. It spoke of the world breaking down into an imperialist, American-dominated, and a democratic, Soviet-influenced bloc. By January 1949, the Soviet bloc had created its own economic framework, the Comecon, Council for Mutual Economic Assistance, as a counterpart to the American-sponsored Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan confirmed the division of Europe into two hostile blocs. The steps to create a West German state cemented the division. By June 1948, the Western Allies had agreed to the establishment of a West German state. They introduced a currency reform that provided the financial basis for economic revival and which many Germans later came to view as the real end to the Second World War for their country. The introduction of the D-Mark, Deutschmark, and the lifting of price controls on many products shortly afterwards saw a rapid end to the black market and the beginning of economic normality. The Soviets responded with their own new currency in the Eastern Zone. Far more threateningly, they imposed a blockade on land connections between the Western Zones and the capital city, Berlin, itself under four-power control but uneasily located about 150 kilometers inside the Soviet zone. The Soviet aim was to force the Western Allies out of Berlin. The Americans saw Berlin as a test case. The communist coup in Czechoslovakia was fresh in their minds. Retreat from Berlin would, they feared, be the prelude to the Soviets extending their stranglehold over Western Europe. The blockade was broken by an improvised Allied airlift, beginning on the 26th of June, that delivered 2.3 million tons of supplies to the blockaded population in Berlin's Western Zones in 278,000 flights, carried out over a period of 321 days, before Stalin finally conceded defeat by lifting the blockade on the 12th of May 1949. For the Western powers, the airlift naturally provided a propaganda triumph and signalled the readiness and determination of the Americans to stay in Europe as a safeguard against the spread of communist power. Later in May, West German representatives drew up a basic law, a constitution, for what was now foreseen as the Federal Republic of Germany, West Germany. The Federal Republic duly came into being on the 20th of September 1949. The Soviets were by this time reconciled to the creation of a separate state in their own zone. On the 7th of October, the division of Germany for the indefinite future, many presumed forever, was sealed with the foundation in the former Eastern Zone of the German Democratic Republic. Over an extremely brief period, Germany had been transformed in Western eyes from a threat to the future security of the continent to the bulwark against Soviet expansion. The French and British, meeting at Dunkirk in March 1947, had signed a defensive treaty, still directed against the possibility of future German aggression. Within a year, this was extended in the Treaty of Brussels, to which the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg added their signatures. But the Soviet Union, no longer Germany, was by now coming to be regarded as the main threat. The growing fear of Soviet power, together with the commitment of the United States to stay on the European continent indefinitely, meant that it was crucial to incorporate the USA formally in the security arrangements for the defence of Western Europe. The Berlin crisis, which fully revealed how exposed Western Europe would be without American military power to underpin it, was the spur to the creation of an Atlantic alliance as a barrier to any potential Soviet expansionism. On the 4th of April 1949, the Brussels signatories, together with the USA, Canada, Italy, Portugal, Denmark, Norway, and Iceland, signed the Treaty of Washington, establishing the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, committing themselves to mutual assistance in the event of an attack against any one of them. NATO offered Western Europe a sense of security that its own threadbare defences couldn't provide. Its importance was to a large extent symbolic, as an expression of unified commitment to the defence of Western Europe. In reality, it was a fig leaf. Soviet ground forces outnumbered those of the Western Allies by 12-1, and only two of the latter's 14 divisions stationed in Europe were American. Very soon, European security had in any case to be rethought. On the 29th of August 1949, the Soviet Union exploded its first atomic bomb at a test site in modern-day Kazakhstan. It was a shock to the West. The Americans had imagined that their nuclear superiority would last for much longer. Instead, the two military superpowers glowered at each other across the Iron Curtain that now formed Europe's great divide. With a rapidly expanding nuclear arsenal on both sides, the Cold War now froze quickly into two great antagonistic power blocks. It would remain that way for the next four decades. By 1949, it was becoming clearer that, in very different ways, both Eastern and Western Europe were on the way to levels of stability and economic growth that had been impossible to foresee four troubled years earlier. The contrast with the protracted turmoil that had followed the First World War was stark. What explains it? Five crucial elements interacted to provide the foundations for the unpredictable transformation that fully materialized only during the 1950s. The end of German great power ambitions, the impact of the purging of war criminals and collaborators, the crystallization of Europe's division into lasting form, the economic growth that was beginning to take off by the end of the 1940s, and the new threat of atomic and soon thermonuclear warfare. A crucial and destructive element of continuity running through and scarring European history from the period before the First World War to 1945 had been Germany's ambitions to become a world power, even the dominant world power. Those ambitions had formed part of the background to the explosion of 1914. They had subsided but not been extinguished under the ill-fated democracy after 1918, and they had returned with greatly magnified aggression after 1933, leading directly to the Second World War in 1939. But they had been smashed once and for all in the total defeat of 1945. The removal of this geopolitical turbulence of great force at the very heart of Europe gave the continent, even in the division of the Cold War, a new chance. The purging of collaborators and those guilty of the worst war crimes, inadequate and unsatisfactory as they were, not only offered a degree of catharsis to the victims of Nazism and collaboration, but meant that the violent politics of the extreme right had no opportunity to poison societies as they had done after 1918. A determining component of interwar political instability had all but disappeared. The border shifts and population transfers in Eastern Europe, though carried out amid terrible bloodshed, produced far greater degrees of ethnic homogeneity than had existed in the interwar period. That too added to the pacification of the eastern half of the continent, even though this took place under the heavy hand of Soviet repression. Perverse though it might seem, the Iron Curtain that divided Europe proved a basis for stability, though at a heavy cost to the peoples of Eastern Europe, condemned to decades of Soviet domination. The more the Soviet Union asserted its monolithic control over Eastern Europe, the more determined the Americans became to confront it by exerting their own influence over Western Europe. Berlin, soon to become the one opening in the Iron Curtain through which millions of refugees poured in a one-way stream, turned into the symbol of American defense of the West following the Allied airlift of 1948. Without the US presence and the sense of protection it offered, it's hard to imagine anything approaching the extent of stability that the ideological blanket of anti-communism helped to create in the West. It wasn't that there were any Soviet military plans to expand into Western Europe, though such expansion was certainly feared at the time. But without American support for rebuilding Western economies, underpinning fragile political systems, providing a defense umbrella, and leading a propaganda assault on the threat of communism, West European communist parties might well have attracted greater support and lessened the chances of establishing stable pluralist democracy. Whether, if the Americans had indeed pulled out of Europe by 1947, as they had initially intended to do, the gravely weakened former European great powers, France and Britain, would have been capable of overseeing the successful reconstruction of Western Europe, is doubtful. The American presence in Europe guaranteed the triumph of capitalism there. That was certainly not universally welcomed. The left, quite especially, hated it. Nor was the growing Americanization of Europe, as many saw it, warmly greeted everywhere. As before the war, it was dismissed in some circles as a sign of Europe's cultural decline. Whatever disadvantages the lasting American presence brought, however, they were greatly outweighed by the advantages. Under the shield of the United States, Western Europe had the opportunity to find its own forms of unity and start to put the nationalist dangers of the recent past behind it. This might not have been possible anyway, had not economic growth provided the basis for the unprecedented levels of prosperity that, despite the post-war austerity, soon started to become visible. The Marshall Plan, though not the cause of the growth, symbolized the new hopes for the future in Western Europe. Instead of reparations, which had helped undermine economic stability in the 1920s, there was the impetus of American loans. Marshall aid gave European economies important sustenance and, as a report in 1951 put it, the strength to work their own recovery. Huge amounts of spare labour and productive capacity, pent-up demand and technical innovation lay behind the surge. Lessons learnt about reliance on market forces to restore pre-war conditions, as had prevailed after the First World War, and the application of Keynesian techniques of monetary policy to stimulate growth also played a significant part. And Western Europe became more economically interwoven with the technologically advanced and prosperous USA than ever before. Eastern Europe, rejecting Marshall aid, soon came to lag far behind the western half of the continent. But beneath the unremitting Soviet repression, economic growth there too accelerated sharply after the war, and material progress was impressive. Where impoverished and underdeveloped societies have been torn apart by nationalist, ethnic, and class conflicts in the interwar years, there was now a basis of relative prosperity and stability, however forced the process had been. Finally, nuclear weapons concentrated mines on both sides of the Iron Curtain. The existence of such weapons of immense destruction, soon of far greater power than the atomic bombs that had destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki, offered such frightening prospects that they diminished the chances of hot, not just cold, war between the new superpowers. With the discovery of the hydrogen bomb, both the USA and the Soviet Union had acquired by 1953 the potential for mutually assured destruction, aptly shortened to MAD. The possession of nuclear weapons would soon come to be one of the most hugely contested strands of domestic politics in Europe, particularly once Britain and France, anxious to ensure their continuing place at the top table of great powers, had acquired them. But once discovered and actually used, as they had been by the Americans twice in 1945, they couldn't be wished away. Their very presence continues, unsurprisingly, to be viewed with fear, and the possibility that they might sometime be used regarded with outright horror. But it seems highly likely, even if it can't actually be proved, that the possibility of a nuclear superpower confrontation, which could have brought about a calamitous Third World War, was crucial to establishing a stability in the divided Europe after 1945 that had never been possible at the end of the first great European conflagration in 1918. Europe's future in 1945, insofar as it appeared to have one, seemed to be that of a continent of independent nation-states. And as Europe congealed into its two separate halves, it was still a continent of nation-states. But this was starting to change. In Eastern Europe, the military power of the USSR meant the rapid subordination of national interests to those of the Soviet Union. The sovereignty of the nation-state quickly ceased to exist. The countries of Western Europe, though increasingly under American influence, were more sensitive to inroads into national sovereignty, none more so than Britain and France. Few people in the first years after the war talked about supranational political entities, and when Winston Churchill did envisage a United States of Europe in 1946, he neither included Britain in his proposed new political entity, nor imagined a world that wasn't still dominated by the great powers, in which category he was determined to ensure Britain's presence. But the emerging Cold War, and the need to ensure that the shoot of economic growth weren't killed off by nationalist rivalries, combined to create the beginnings of pressure for greater coordination and integration of both the economies and the security of Western Europe. The formation of the Organization for European Economic Cooperation, OEEC, in 1948, and the following year of NATO and the Council of Europe, committed to European cooperation in matters relating to the rule of law and the upholding of fundamental human rights, marked a modest start. Combining idealism and pragmatism, these were still fairly small steps on the way towards reconciling national interests with greater levels of European integration. The historic splits were too deep to allow national interests to be swiftly or comprehensively overcome, and Britain especially was allergic to any possible diminution of its status or sovereignty. When the French advanced the scheme, the Schuman Plan, in 1950 for joint control of Ruhr coal and steel production, questions of national security through controlling Germany's potential for rearmament following the foundation of the Federal Republic of Germany were more important than idealistic notions of European unity. But it turned out to be the decisive step, the beginning of the path that would lead to a common market and the creation of a European economic community with its own governing institutions. Out of the ashes, against all probabilities, a new Europe, divided within itself, but with each part soon resting on more solid foundations than had ever seemed likely at the end of the war, had with remarkable speed taken distinct shape. The future lay open, but amid the lasting scars, physical and moral, of the most terrible war of all time, possibilities were emerging of a more stable and prosperous Europe than could ever have been imagined within living memory in the decades when the continent had come close to self-destruction. The end. This is John Curlis. We hope you have enjoyed this production of To Hell and Back, Europe 1914-1949 by Ian Kershaw. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you. for being a recorded books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.